Look at this. And if a scholarly lecture is given in Germany, you can be sure that 90% of the time the German speaker will say, already the ancient Greek knew that something, you see? And we have the same situation here, because when it comes to acoustics, I don't have to tell you what the meaning of the word is. It is so that even the ancient Greeks knew already that it has two sides, namely the physical side on the one hand and the perceptual side on the other hand, which has been forgotten by many physicists in the meantime. But we, as room acousticians and building acousticians, we know that. We have to take care of perception all the time. So let's go a little bit, just in the beginning, a little bit into the history of acoustics. And, it started with just the physical side and the perceptual side. But then a few interesting things happened. Namely, already at the end of the 19th century, TV was invented by a German called Nipkow. You may have heard about the Nipkow disc. It was a mechanical device to scan a picture. And also, at about the same time, Waldemar Pausel, a Dane, invented the magnetophon, the magnetic recording process. And also, sound on film was invented already, but nothing happened. It was just in the scientific community. It needed kind of an additional thing to get the whole thing kicked off, and that was the invention of the vacuum tube. You see, the German Robert von Lieben and Lee de Forest, they invented a device with which you could now amplify weak currents. And that was needed, because now amplifiers could be done. And then the whole thing took off the ground, and we had killer applications like radio broadcasts, sound on film, public address systems, loudspeakers, and things like that. The interesting thing now is now that electrical engineering came into the play. So the nice marriage of physics and perception now became more complicated, because it was now a three-party thing. From then on, we called our field electroacoustics. This was about the time when I started, which was in the late 50s, that we called our institutes of electroacoustics. But then another important thing happened during my professional career, namely, computers came into play, as you know. And my key experiment was Manfred Schroeder's talk in 1986, a long time ago, at the ICA in Tokyo. He came from AT&T Bell Labs, and he gave a talk on computers and acoustics. At that time, we all recognized that this will be the tool of the future, and including computers, I, at that time, already called my group communication acoustics. Change from electroacoustics to communication acoustics. And this is now a well-accepted term. In the meantime, I could name something like 10 laboratories worldwide, especially in China, by the way. They were the first to change to this new name. So it's kind of a fancy term in a way. So this is my operational definition of communication acoustics. Anything in acoustics which relates to communication, both science and technology, for instance, speech technology, public address systems, but also other things. And I would like to take a more fundamental approach today and also talk about the application to room acoustics, because this is a conference with a certain focus on architectural acoustics. The evolution of communication acoustics and its impact on room acoustics. Let me start with a simple paradigm in communication acoustics, which everybody knows. If you have the task to provide authentic reproduction of a sound or a sound scene from one point to another point in space or in time, then one way that you could go is that you have an artificial head, you stick microphones into the ear of a person, and then you take those signals and you record them, and you have to correct them, of course, because you want to replay them through headphones. Now, if you produce exactly the same signals at the two ears, at the receiving end, that you have picked up at the pickup end, would you then say that the subject hears the same thing? Who agrees on that statement? Who does not agree? Well, actually, this is the basic assumption of binaural technology, but it's wrong, because everybody knows what you hear depends on what you know about the scene, on your selection, on your attention, on your emotion, and things like that. But from a scientific point, it's a good point to start with. But you have to be careful, because that will be part of the message of my talk. It's not that simple. The human being is a multimodal, intelligent receiver. So it is much more complicated, with something like 18 to the power of 12 cells in our head, you see? It's a very complicated thing. But anyhow, if I plot this in engineering terms, then I would come up with something like this. Everybody will understand that. This is the real or dummy head. And then we have some kind of a system. The system must have a memory because we want to store, and some signal processing because we have to correct. In other words, we have a computer here. And if you go to today's studio, even the mixing console is a computer, everything is a computer. So we have a certain signal processing power in our systems all the time. And then you listen to that. So what does this guy do, or she, when they are listening? Well, they listen, they analyze, they judge, they categorize, they understand, and they evaluate, amongst other things, unless they just enjoy the music. That's another thing. But we are talking about science here. Now, I told you that we have the computer power already. One idea would be to say, why can't we do everything that the brain does and the auditory system does on the computer? And the outcome of the computer could be a parametric representation of the auditory scene. For instance, if you have a speech recognizer, then you put the speech in, and what comes out is a series of letters. That would be a parametric representation, something like that. Okay, this would be one idea, and actually we'll work on that. So we try to substitute the person here by a computer. Well, if we carry this idea further, then we have talked about this part. And if we do this, if we take a dummy head and then a signal processing and the output is parameters which describe the original scene, then we have what we call these days computational auditory scene analysis, or CASA. But once we have the parametric description of the world, you could come up with the idea of, why do we need the real world at all? Why don't we just take the computer and take the parameter as an input and recreate a new world from that? If I take this example of the speech recognizer, which as an output would have recognized characters, then this could go into a text-to-speech system, and what comes out is speech again. That would be virtual speech. I mean, that's the basic paradigm of a coding system for speech transmission, which goes really down to the level of graphemes. And the same we could think about auditory scenes, that we have some way of describing them. You find this in MP4 these days, a language to describe auditory scenes, and from that we recreate the world. Okay, now what has all this to do with our field of room acoustics? Well, I'll show you that this has a lot of to do with the tools which we use. And I want to start with this part here, with the virtual reality part, which many of you who work as consultants may already have as a room simulation system. It's a package of computer programs, and you start out with putting the geometrical data of a room into the system, and including the absorption coefficients for the different walls. And if it's a good system, you also have the receiver characteristics, which means the HRTFs in the system, and maybe even the directional characteristics of the sender. If it's a talking person or if it's a loudspeaker, all this can be in the system. And the system then creates a model of the sound field, which is actually, in most representations, a cloud of virtual sound sources. And the interesting thing is, if you have this cloud of secondary sources, virtual sources, and you ignite them at the same time, you send out a direct impulse from all of them at the same time, then what comes on here, which receives at the receiver, includes the complete information about the room. You get a binaural impulse response, and for this listening position, all the information about the room is in this cloud of virtual sound sources. So the consultant then takes dry music and echoic music, convolves that with the binaural impulse responses, and then you can listen into a room which only exists on the drawing board, but not in reality. This is our daily bread, so to say, as consultants. We have to do that all the time. But it's a static thing. It's not real time. It really takes time. Okay, but now there's one bad thing about it. And the bad thing is when you move your head about, you know that when you use your MP3 player, then the whole world will move with you, the auditory world, which the system creates. And we don't want that. So what do we have to do? We have to tell the system where the hat is at a given point in time. We do this with a hat tracker. And the information goes back to the computer, and the computer then modifies the signals to the two ear in such a way that they are in conformity with the actual position of the hat. But that is a big step, because from now on you really have to calculate in real time. Because when you move your hat, then the computer has to be so fast that the delay of the computer is not perceived. And then we are in a different category. And this we call virtual reality. These days you can actually walk through a room on the computer where the music is playing with this system. So we have an interactive system where the subject interacts with a virtual world. Because in the computer you have an image of the virtual world, including all the objects in the world and the rules which apply between the different objects. For instance, Newton's mechanic or other things which in real world terms have to be programmed into the virtual world. Any modern computer game has this in it already. This is a system that we built a few years ago, but it's already old-fashioned because, especially in the game industry, we have far more advanced systems. But the point here, which I want to make in my talk, is the following. Oh, just before I do this, I just want to tell you what the main application areas for virtual reality these days are, and you find them on this slide. But interesting is this line here, because this is what we have to deal with as acousticians, room acousticians. For instance, concert halls, recording studios, listening rooms, mixing rooms, rehearsal rooms, they are only virtual in this context. But a consultant has also to give consultancy to virtual room, because from a perceptual point of view, it's the same like a real room. So if you want to design a virtual room, you need the room acoustician, the consultant, as much as you would need him or her for the real rooms. So it's our field. And the point which I want to make is the following. This is the block diagram of a virtual reality generator. So you have the afferent and the efferent channels. So here the hand position is measured, the head position is measured, and then the sound field is created and then played to the system here. But everything interacts with the nucleus of the system, which is the model of the virtual world, which everything that we know about the world, maybe even information from other senses. Here we have tactile input, and we may also have visual input and visual output. So a multimodal virtual reality system. And the point is that here you need a lot of knowledge about the world and a lot of intelligence. So we find that in communication acoustics we need cognitive elements to build our systems. Now let's go to the other side, namely to the analysis side. Again, just some application areas for computational auditory scene analysis, and here are the ones which are interesting for us as acousticians. You can use those analysis systems to map the sound field, to find out where the sound sources are and what kind of a room it is, where the reflections come from. You can also use it to do sound quality analysis. And this is the point which I would like to pick up in this talk. Let me just explain to you beforehand how such a system is built and what the architecture of the system is. The input to the system is the two signals to the two ears. So you can either take it from a dummy head, or what we often do these days, we have an electronic version of the dummy head, including all the HRTFs. It's only for specialists. It's not the important thing. So the ear signals go into the system, one from the left side and one from the other side, from the right side. And now they go through a very nice thing, which is the inner ear or the cochlea, which does some interesting things. First of all, it decomposes the incoming signals into frequency bands. It's kind of a Fourier analyzer. So now we have signals in bands. And then they are a little bit compressed. And then we have a very nice A to D conversion, because the mechanical signal is transformed into neural spikes. So now we get a stream of neural spikes from this side in all bands and from the other side, and they have to be combined somehow. And this is the interesting thing, because the information which is buried in the difference of the two ear signals is the information that we want to use. And there are only two things which can be in the signals as a difference, because the outer sound field is a linear system. So you only have amplitude and phase as a difference to the two ears. We don't talk about amplitude and phase, we call it level and arrival time difference. ITD and ILD. That's the same thing. It's a linear system. Now, this model has to, it's a battery of computer programs, actually. That's what it is. It has to evaluate the time differences and the level differences. Okay. This is the same system, just in a different way of plotting it. You see, we have the external ear, then we have kind of a middle ear module, but that's not very important here. Then we have the cochlea, and then we have the interoral level difference analysis and interoral time difference analysis. And we also have to take into account that you can still hear when you close one ear. So when one ear is closed, then we have also mono processors, but I don't want to talk about those. This is the interesting thing here. This is the step here which does the evaluation of interoral time differences. And you have a signal from the left side and the right side. If it's the same signal and there were only a time shift between the two, then when you calculate the cross-correlation of the two, then you will find a peak with a certain shift from the middle. If you have more than one sound sources, you would find a peak for that time difference wherever a sound source is. So actually, the idea is that we do some kind of interoral cross-correlation to do two things. First, identify sound sources in the space, and secondly, find out where they are positioned in the auditory scene. So if we look at such a cross-correlatogram, this is a typical cross-correlatogram, I'll explain this to you, which comes out of the system. So we have a loudspeaker in front of a person in a room, which radiates an ongoing musical chord. So a basic fundamental sound and harmonics. This is the fundamental sound here. It's here at 200 Hz. Then you find the first harmonic here and higher harmonics here. That you see a shallow slope here and a steep slope on the other side, this is because of the ear filters, because the band filters in the ear have a funny shape. They have a steep slope and a shallow slope. And you find this in the correlatogram. The idea is we have a means to create some binaural activity pattern from our model which we can interpret, and by interpretation we get an idea what the original sounds are, because we want to analyze the sound field and describe it in parametric terms. Now, a room acoustician could have the idea, why not take binaural impulse responses from a concert hall and let them run to the system? If you take the dummy head and record the impulse responses in a room and then send them through the system, then you get very interesting pictures. This one, for example. There was a loudspeaker on the stage in a concert hall radiating a short impulse. And the impulse came from the middle. So what you see here is the impulse, the direct sound. The fancy picture has been done by a colleague from me in Japan who is fond of computer graphics. Our system itself, I'll show you later, is not that fancy, but I like this fancy, glossy little picture here. And what you see here are the reflections. The reflections in the middle come from the ceiling, and the reflections to the side come from the reflective sidewalls. So this, any room acoustician will say, this gives me quite a good idea of what's happening in the room. Reflections coming from the side and those coming from the front. Let's compare two concert halls. These are two concert halls, some of you may know them. This here is the Großer Musikvereinssaal in Vienna. Some people say it's the best hall in the world. And this is one which before renovation was not so very good, the Philharmonie in Munich, Gasteig. You see, this is a fan-shaped plan and this is a rectangular plan. This is the lower floor, the balcony, and this is the lower floor. It's not very figurative picture, but you'll understand that. It's a shoebox hall. Okay, now let's look at the impulse echograms in binaural form when they come out of the system. This is Gasteig, and you see the Müller BBN acousticians who were the consultants knew that they have to provide lateral reflections, but they are not very dense. You have two very strong lateral reflections, so the room is only fair in terms of spaciousness. I'll come back to that. Now this is Musikanzahl. You see a lot of reflections from all sides. So, but now comes the point. If we as acousticians see those plots, to interpret them, we need a lot of knowledge about the scene. We have to know what's important, what's not, what kind of music do we want to play in this room, what is this all for, is this a normal concert hall for classic romantic music, or is this a hall with electroacoustic amplification for rock music or for plenary sessions or whatever. So you need expertise to interpret and evaluate the outcome of binaural models. So actually, we have to put something on top. This is what comes out of the model. You get these excitation patterns. Now you have to do something. You have to pre-segment them, like a speech analyzer would pre-segment the sound into phones or phonemes. And then you put them on a blackboard. And then you have different experts, computer programs, of course, who try to interpret what's on the blackboard. They come up with a hypothesis. And then the hypothesis is tested, and they say, yes, it could be that, or it's not that. So all the knowledge, including all the subjectivity of the different experts, can be put up here. This is, so to say, the brain of the system. So at the analysis side, our systems become more and more intelligent, so also on the synthesis side in virtual reality. So if we look at this in a synopsis, then I can offer you this picture. You see, this is the analysis side and this is the synthesis side. Both of them need a brain. And this is new in acoustics, isn't it? That we have to consider the brain also. And now we learn more and more about the brain, so it's about time for engineers to consider this and to import knowledge about the brain and use this in our technical context. So we find this milestone, what's currently happening in communication acoustics, and I think it is extremely interesting because now the human being is involved, and you always find students when you say we do something with a human being. That's really interesting. And another even more complicating factor is that very often the communication acoustics elements are only elements of a broader system, a greater system, a bigger system in communication, so they are an embedded system. You have to see them in the functional context. So this is what's happening in communication acoustics. And now let's see what that means for our field, room acoustics. Second part of my talk. Well, when we talk about quality, room acousticians knew about quality since centuries. But in the noise control field, this quality discussion started in the beginning of the 80s again. And since then we talk about noise quality. It's an absurd term, of course, but sound quality would be better. And then people said, okay, so far we measured our sounds in dBA, but we found out this is not enough. We need more. Maybe we need impulsiveness. Maybe we need the spectrum, or other things. And after they had measured this, maybe even measured some psychoacoustical things like loudness or pitch or so, and they came up with sensory profiles and physical profiles of a sound, and then they called this quality. But in the meantime, we are careful not to use the word quality in our context in the sense of qualia. So if we only assess the attributes of a sound, and this is normally done by experts, of course, physically or sensorially, then let's call that the character of a sound. It has been, I just suggest to you to do this because we try to put this into an international standard, and there's quite some agreement already to distinguish between character and quality. Why? Because quality is one step more. Sound quality. Once you have the sound character of a sound sample, so you know the physical attributes, sensorially attributes, maybe even emotional attributes, then when you want to rate on quality, whether it's good or bad, then you have to compare it with a reference. This is normally assessed by experts. Also, the reference set is normally assessed by experts. But then the user comes and makes a judgment whether what he actually hears is suitable as compared to a reference. But it can become even more complicated because what he or she is judging upon here is the quality of the sound itself, the sound quality, the sound as such. but it can become more complicated. And unfortunately, when we talk about concert halls, it becomes more complicated. So I have to explain that to you. And the idea comes from product sound quality. Let's see the sound of a car, the interior sound of the car or the exterior sound of the car. Then, definition is slightly different, because now the objective of the sound is not so much to sound beautiful itself, but to relay to you the information that the car is good. So now the sound is used as a sign. It's a communication issue. The sound, it's not the quality of the sound anymore which counts, but it's a sound of quality. Does this car sound like a good car? Has to be relayed. And not like a musical instrument, does the instrument itself sound well, you see? But does it give you the information, which is important? If you the honk of a car, if it's not loud enough, then it's noise, because it is not good for anything. If it's too loud, it's noise again. Only if it fulfills its purpose, namely to warn people at the right level, then it's a sign. Then it's a sign of good quality. So it becomes more complicated. This is what I call the product sound quality circle. You start out with the product, and then you let the product make noise. And this is schematic of the listener. So there is an auditory perceptual part, and this part is influenced by cognition, action, and emotion. When you are sleeping, then you judge and listen different than when you are working at an engine. Also, when you are in a bad mood, then you are disturbed. And if you are alert and in a good mood, you may not be disturbed. And also, what you know about the scene. If you know, you see, one of my friends always had some empty beer bottles in the trunk of his car. And I asked him, why do you do this? And he said, because I know what it is. And all the other noises of the car, I don't know what it is. So they annoy me. But this does not annoy me because I know what it is. This is how we think. This is actually, I mean, it's true. You will immediately agree that this is true. So, and now we judge. And this, the auditory perception is already influenced by cognition, action, and emotion. But now comes the judgment. Because you hear something, this is a character, so to say. And now you judge that against a reference. Quality happens, so to say, in the process. Now you know it's good quality or not. But it only makes sense, the judgment, in relation to this specific product in use. If a good lawnmower, would sound like a coffee machine, like a good coffee machine, then it would say something is wrong, you see? It only makes sense in connection with the specific product that you are looking for. So our modeling, basically the architecture of our model looks like this. We have the character of the sound, we have the reference set, both are ascertained by experts, and then we have a user which in use makes a judgment, which is kind of a distance measure between the two. And the interesting thing is, when you do it this way, then you can put all the task dependency and subjectivity in this block here. So you can somehow separate between the objective part and the more subjective part in your model. It's an idea, seems to work well, but we are in the beginning of this process. I would like to come with a very simple example that every room acoustician knows to go a little bit more deeply in this kind of problem. This is spaciousness. When you go into a concert hall and the orchestra plays low, then what you hear is quite compact. But when they speak up, so to say, then they're becoming louder, then the auditory event gets broader, may fill the complete space. And this is what people like. They call it spaciousness, and a good hall should have a certain amount of spaciousness. Otherwise, people wouldn't like it. They could stay at home, listen to the CD at home. This feeling of being involved by the sound with other people together in the room is to a large extent due to this kind of spaciousness. We know this these days. And the spaciousness physically has to do something with the correlation of the signals to the two ears. This is what we call coherence, the interaural cross-correlation factor, you could say. And any room acoustician knows that when you look at the echogram of a room, then in the late part here, correlation goes down, and this is where we feel spaciousness and reverberance. We do this in our craft by providing lateral reflections to the sound, and this is, by the way, the reason that the shoebox halls sometimes are much better than the fan-shaped halls, unless you really do them well, or even arena-type halls, where the lateral reflections are different in different seats. So this we know, and we know it also, of course, for the section. We need the balconies. If we don't have them in a shallow room, we have to provide reflectors. Okay, now let's take some sounds from a binaural model, as I have explained to you, and put two noises into the ears which are slightly decorrelated. What happens? If the two signals were completely correlated, then you would always have one maximum in the middle. But now that they slightly decorrelated, they wander to the, they move to the left and to the right side. And the area which they cover is the area where you hear something. So this is how spaciousness comes about. Here you see it as a function of time in a certain band, and you hear, here you see it across bands. These are the different frequency bands, and you see, can even see that it's different in the different bands. Well, now, with all the different problems, a very important thing comes up. We know when we talk about quality, we have to talk about the references, because quality always implies a reference. And now I would like to talk to you, and this is very important, and I think that's the new part of my talk. I want to talk to you about different levels of abstractions of the references. The lowest level of abstraction is quality as such. It's kind of a psychoacoustic approach. If you only, with psychoacoustic measurements, measure things like loudness, pitch, maybe even spaciousness, then you would say, well, these are things which have no abstraction because you directly measure the percept. And this may be very subjective, so you get some averages and you get a certain variance of your things. And some psychoacousticians even say there can be something like unbiased sensation. I don't believe in that so much, but it's, again, you see, one of the approximations. They say that loudness is kind of unbiased. If you are really able to judge on loudness, it does not depend on the specific situation. So, consequently, the school of psychoacousticians says, in the laboratory, the subjects shouldn't know anything about the sound source, so the signals that they use shouldn't have any meaning. They should just concentrate on what they hear and describe this in the laboratory context. This is the lowest level. But now what most of the engineers do, they go to the next level, and they even then some, which I call the transmission quality level, actually it's the physical level. When you take a room as a transmission system, so to say, then you have all the things like reverberation time, impulse response, things like that, lateral energy fraction, or tonal balance in terms of spectrum and complete level and things, all these things that you can measure with instruments. And many of us think that this is less abstraction than the psychoacoustic level. It's not the case. Because in physics, you want to get rid of subjectivity. So you only allow for those measurement methods which get rid of subjectivity. But the world is subjective. So when you're on the physical level, it's already a certain construct. So there is more abstraction to it than when you're directly facing the world without explaining the world. Physics already has a model which explains the world, you see? So we have a higher abstraction level here. The next abstraction level is what I call auditory scene quality. Now, in terms of quality, the reference. This is the level where a tonemeister would work, or an audio engineer work. He knows something about the physics and the psychophysics, but what he or she wants to do is they want to create an optimum artistical effect. So they include a lot of psychology. They include a lot of knowledge of the piece of art already. You could also call this the Gestalt level. And things like authenticity, enhancement, oral perspective, and immersion are located at this level. And now we have another level on top of it, and that's the product sound level, because now it is the sound is used as a sign. Now we have cognition, now we have semiotics and things like that included. In terms of music, we are at the level where the composer uses the room as a means for communication. And you have that in many modern pieces, that the spatial attributes are used in the composition as a means, as an element for communication. Then we are on this highest level here. And you see in product sound quality, we are already at this level. What I wanted to say is that we normally are down here as acoustical consultants. We know a lot about the physical parts. We learned that at school. And those who have read Zwicker and my book on spatial hearing may know a little bit on these things here also. And some have good relationship to audio engineers, so they get some experience, some feedback from them. But basically, we are somewhere here. But we have to deal with these things also. And I would like to explain to you some of the problems and the structure of the problems which come up when we start to work on this level here. In this context, I would like to talk about typicalness, functional adequacy, listening tradition, and aesthetic form. Okay, if you go to a restaurant and you order a steak and they bring you an excellent Peking duck, would you say this is a good steak? No. No, you would not. You would say it's an excellent Peking duck. There's something wrong because I ordered a steak. Whether it's a good steak or bad steak is not even the issue at that point, because you say it's not even a steak. But when you get a steak, then you first recognize it's a typical steak. And now the fine shades of the taste tell you whether it's a good chef or a bad chef. See? So, when we build a concert hall, first of all, it must be typical. If it's not typical, it's not a concert hall. And interestingly, there's kind of a standardization amongst critics. They can tell you all over the world whether a hall is a good concert hall, because they have agreed on a common reference. And by agreeing on this reference, they have acquired some level of objectivity, actually. Objectivity means that the result is independent of the specific laboratory or observer. This is what objectivity is. And they can do this. The good critics can do this. They agree amongst each other. But they know what typical is. But what does the architect do to end up at a typical hall? Well, actually, if you look at history, it was a tradition which was given from one generation to the next. They built the hall in the same way, and then they found this one is good and this is... But when somebody comes up with a new plan, and this happens a lot, in the meantime, if you look at Paris or Hamburg or Copenhagen, you now have this vineyard, arena-shaped halls again. But they are still typical concert halls. When you go in them and listen to them, you would say, this is a typical concert hall. It's not something else. It's a concert. It has been built as a concert hall. But now the interesting thing is, take your dummy head, measure the impulse responses at two seats very close by. And the impulse responses are very different. So just with your physical analysis, you cannot find what typicality is. So typicality is something cognitive. So we have to go to this level to even understand what a good concert hall is. So it has to do with functional adequacy. If a hall is good for rock music, it's not necessarily a good hall for classic romantic music. So I want to go into this issue of history a little bit more and look at a classical hall. Classical concert hall goes back to the basilica type, ancient Greek or then Roman kind of building houses. They could have rectangular shapes. They could build a ceiling on top of that, wooden ceiling most of the time. And basilica, we normally call it the basilica kind. And the first concert halls in the 19th century were built after this basilica type of hall. And we call them the classical hall, like the one in Vienna. And we have them since more than 100 years. And also the music has been composed for this kind of hall. You can study this with Haydn. When he was in different cities, his music changed a little bit according to the hall that he was playing in. And also the instruments, the classical instruments, were built in a development period of about 100 years to our classical instruments, with the nice sound and the high efficiency of which these instruments have. Okay, things like that. And then, of course, the human voice is also good in a classical hall. Program Baroque classical romantic music. But now, after the war especially, two things happened. First, we had concrete as a building material, so we were not so much restricted by the old basilica technology. And secondly, the artists became more and more expensive, so you had to put more people into the hall. So we came with the modern concert halls, fan-shaped, most of them, also more than 100 years altogether, if we look at it. And now we have different music. We have modern music, also romantic music, with many, many musicians. But still, it's still stationary acoustics. But now, again, as I told you already when I talked about history, in the 20s, 1920, electroacoustics came into play. First, from an analog point of view. And now we have this situation. Analogous electroacoustic installations, like a reverberator. Also, analog electroacoustic instruments, like the Hammond organ, or the electric guitar, or the Fender piano, and things like that. They are still, in a way, static, but you can turn a control knob and can adjust them to the, but it takes some time. And people, since we have those instruments for a certain time now, they know already about the aesthetics of those instruments, and some kind of a quality reference has evolved. I mean, if you want to have a certain steel reverberation plate, which some people collect to have them back, they know exactly what the typical sound of this reverberation plate is, or a Fender piano, or a certain kind of a guitar, you see? The fans want to have just this, because from a static point, they think this is better than that. But now let's look at today's technology. This is still hardware. But now we sample sound, or we generate them electronically. And there's one interesting side thought to that. Now we have software only, and it doesn't take energy anymore. You don't have to move anything to go from one room to the next. You just press a button. You see, because the electron has almost no mass. You don't need effort, physical effort to do it. And that means that you can do anything at any time. You have a freedom which we never had before, but we don't have a tradition. So unless you're in specific circles, you don't have a tradition. So people who are exposed to new sounds, they can't use any knowledge. They can't use any high-order abstract reference systems. They go back to the very, very low, purely psychoacoustical end and say, does it sound nice or doesn't it sound loud? Is it loud or is it low? Is it broad? Is it balanced or isn't it balanced? And you have to teach them again to understand what all this means. So this is important. What do the young people with all the freedom? Well, actually, they say, I know about the music of the Beatles. I know about the music. I'm a jazz musician. I know about mainstream jazz. You see, we categorize again. We don't use the freedom. Only within a certain field of knowledge we come to the point that we can interpret the music and understand, and more than just the story, so to say, we also understand the poem, we understand the emotion, the whole thing, but we need the knowledge. We have to learn the language of the sounds before we can interpret them. Or in terms of my reference systems, I told you, consultants only work here, but the people who say, I'm interested in the sound of the 50s, are up here. So what do we have to do as consultants? We have to extend our field down to psychoacoustics. We have to learn more about psychoacoustics, and we have to include the Gestalt level, and we have to include the level sound as a sign carrier, because sound in the communication context wants to relay meaning. So what are the up-to-date tasks of a consultant? Providing references. Well, you know that. In the old days, we had to go from one concert hall to the next. These days, we have recordings in our studio, and we let the client listen to the recordings, and we agree on kind of a sound that he wants to have, modify that electronically. You see, this is references. And then we set and specify a traditional or less traditional sound. Then prototyping. We have to understand what the invariant components are. If we want to have a typical concert hall, what can we vary and what can't we vary, because otherwise we would lose typicality. And then education. You have to educate your client. Unless the client speaks the same language like you do. You see, a client comes to you and says, I want to do a concert hall with you. And then you say, what kind of a concert hall do you want? And then he says, I want to have a good hall. See, that doesn't help you. You have to talk to him for a while until you have a means of communication and you can agree on things. Maybe you need further experts, and the client brings his friends who know more about it, musicians most of the time, which is not easy, and then you talk more to them, and then you try to build that. And then next thing is you have to transform this knowledge specification into built form. The consultant has to know, how do I have to build this to get this result? Or if you do it electroacoustically or in virtual reality, what are the specifics of the impulse responses or so that I want to do? So in the end, it turns out, and I proposed this many years ago in America, I said, we acoustical consultants should not call ourselves architectural acoustics consultants anymore. We should call ourselves acoustical architects. And in the meantime, Barry Blesser has written his book on Spaces Speak, Do You Listen? Should look at this book, it's a very interesting book. And he says, even better in American language is the word oral architecture. So we as consultants have to turn our profession into all architecture. So we have to learn more about the Gestalt level and the highest level, the cognitive level, because this is what makes the creativity. And be assured, ladies and gentlemen, we should read the world from the listener's point of view when we want to be good acoustical consultants, because our little system here with which we hear has the peripheral part, the two cochlea and the brain stem. These tell you about the form of the sounds, where and how is the sound, but the brain up there, the cortex, tells you what does this sound mean to me. And people, there's no doubt, make their decision on what it means to them and not on how it sounds. So we have to go up there. And this was my message. Thank you very much.